Very convincing argument, I think, for this norm. And what I want to do today is to try to defend the truth norm against the challenges of, of a knowledge norm, and also provide some criticism of the knowledge norm. So I take it as a commitment. Before it was a pleasure for me to defend the truth norm, now it's for me a commitment to defend it, because the motto of my university is aim at truth. The competing university is aim at knowledge. So I should take it very seriously. So a popular view in epistemology holds that belief is an attitude constitutively governed by a norm. Philosophers defend this norm on the basis that this norm would be able to distinguish belief from other psychological attitudes, explain a bunch of things about belief, such as the difficulty or impossibility of believing at will, the infelicity of asserting moral sentences, motivational force of evidential considerations. And more importantly, it will play a grounding role in epistemic normativity. The idea is that the most fundamental constitutive norm of belief can explain all the rest of epistemic normativity, so derivative epistemic standards, the nature of epistemic reasons, epistemic justification, and a bunch of. So this is a very ambitious project. And an ongoing debate on the norm of belief concerns what this norm requires or permits, so what the norm is. And the aim of this talk is to compare the prospect of two main proposals. One is the idea that truth is the norm of belief. So the idea is that we shouldn't believe what is false, and maybe we should believe part of what is true, and believe the truth in specific circumstances. The other proposal is the knowledge norm, the idea that we shouldn't believe what we don't know. So here I presented those norms without paying much attention to the formulation, the details in the formulation. This norm comes in narrow and wide scope versions. In the case of truth norms, some philosophers defend only the 1.1, not the 0.2. They don't think that there are positive obligations. But I will skip for the moment those details, and we'll come back later in the talk. So in this talk, I argue that we should prefer a truth norm to a knowledge norm. This is the plan of the talk. In the first part, I will introduce some preliminary remarks on belief, epistemic normativity, and why I don't consider other candidate norms. I will be quite fast on this for reason of time. If you have any question, you can stop me or ask in the Q&A. In the second part, I consider two advantages of the truth norm over the knowledge norm. And in the last part, I defend the truth norm against some arguments supposed to favor the knowledge norm, in particular one argument, a recent argument quite popular in the literature. So let's start with some preliminary remark. The relevant notion of belief figuring in the norm is flat out or outer belief, not partial belief or confidence. So very briefly, an outer belief involves a settled opinion in a believed proposition. It involves closing the question, whether P, for the subject. It is often accompanied by a sense of knowing, and this is expressed normally by flat-out assertion. Partial belief has not those properties. So I think you are quite familiar with this. Then another assumption is that I assume here a deontic conception of the norm belief, not merely evaluative or functional. So that a certain belief is false or is not knowledge, according to this view, is not just bad or disvaluable, but wrong, inappropriate, defective, not as it ought to be. But I also assume a minimally deontic conception. So minimal deontic conception. So it's a deontic conception in the sense that it is reason providing. It provides reason for doxastic attitudes. And doesn't need to have the extreme voluntarist or responsabilist implications that some philosophers attribute to the deontic conception of, for example, justification. I have some reason why I favor the deontic conception based on the terminology that is analogous to the terminology, deontic terminology in other domains, and logical structure of epistemic normativity, which is very similar to deontic the structure of deontic norms in other domain, and for example, sufficiency thresholds are very common in the logics of deontic norms and uncommon in the logics of values, and the logic of reason in epistemology involves thresholds. So for those reasons, I think that. So the normal belief involves an epistemic kind of normativity, as opposed to a moral, prudential, legal, aesthetic, all things considered, other type of normativity. This is something you are already familiar with, I think. So only truth relevant evidential consideration may be relevant to what a subject is epistemically permitted or required to believe. All other considerations, practical considerations, are irrelevant. And the aim of this talk is, as I said, to compare the truth norm and the knowledge norm. So I assume here, for the sake of argument, that one of these norms is right. But let me briefly mention why I think that these are the most promising candidates. So there is at least one another candidate in the literature that's quite popular, is the evidential norm, the idea that for a subject, a subject should believe a proposition only if it's sufficiently supported by evidence, and sometimes even believe a proposition when it's decisively supported by evidence. So as many other philosophers, I think that something like this norm can be at most derivative from a more fundamental norm. It's not fundamental. And also find extremely compelling the various arguments for effective normal belief. And given that the two main effective candidates are a knowledge norm and the truth norm, this is why I focus on those proposals. So here I have a list of consideration for effective norms, but it's better that I skip, otherwise I will not be able to conclude the discussion. If you have some question on this, I can come back in the Q&A. So a final remark is on the method. Some of my arguments use an analogical method. They presuppose that various normative domains share important deep similarities. And in particular, I will often appeal to analogies between epistemic norms and norms in the practical domains, in other practical domains. So, for example, I will use analogies between epistemic norms and traffic regulations, moral norms like promise keeping. And so I agree with many other philosophers that this is a powerful method to investigate specific features of normative system in different domains, because I think that there are deep structural similarities between various deontic normative domains. And also this method is widely employed by defenders of knowledge norms. In particular, Williamson, for example, systematically appeals to analogies with promise keeping, and also Clayton sometimes often uses analogies with the practical domain. So let me start with the advantages of truth norm over the knowledge norm. So the first advantage is based on consideration about the phenomenology of norm regulation and the way in which we follow norms in the practical and epistemic domain. Let me start with the phenomenology of doxastic deliberation. I think that this phenomenology favors the truth norm over the knowledge norm. Let's start consider a case in the practical domain where we look at when we deliberate about what to do is usually a quite reliable detector of what we ought or are permitted to do. In normal circumstances, when we try to follow practical norms, we look at whether the conditions required by these norms are satisfied. So, for example, in trying to decide whether to cross the road, in normal circumstances, I look at whether the traffic lights are red, and not, for example, at my perceptual or cognitive faculties. There can be exceptions to this rule, but those are abnormal circumstances, such as, for example, if I arrive at a crossroad, I'm completely drunk, and I know that I cannot discriminate whether the light is red or green. In this case, it makes sense not only to look at the color of the traffic light, but also at my abilities of discriminating colors. But those are exceptions. In normal cases, when we follow norms, we just look at the condition of the norm. So this indicates that in this type of case, what I am required to do is not to cross the road if the lights are red. And in fact, this is precisely what the law requires in such cases. So it seems that what we look at when we deliberate about what to do is a good detector of what the norm requires. So we can generalize from this consideration in the practical domain. So if you look at the weather conditions, C are satisfied when we try to follow a norm. In most cases, C are the conditions required by the norm. And more rarely, and in specific circumstances, we look at conditions necessary to satisfy C, such as in the case, special case in which I am at a traffic light and I am drunk. So in a similar way, when deliberating whether to believe at P, we normally do not look at our mental attitudes in order to form the belief, and in particular at whether we know certain thing or whether we would thereby know by believing at P. What we look at is whether P is true, and what determines the answer to the question whether to believe is determined by the truth of P. This is something that already many other philosophers pointed out, in particular Nishisha. But a few philosophers recognize the fact that this not only seems to be an argument for a factive norm, but it seems to be also an argument for the truth norm and against the knowledge norm, because we look at the truth, not at knowledge. So a common potential reply to this point is that knowledge is factive, it entails truth. So in order to ensure whether we know that P, we must look at whether P is true. Truth is a necessary condition to satisfy the norm, and this is why we look at it in deliberation. So the move is to look at the necessary condition rather than at for the compliance, the conformity to a norm, rather than at the condition required by the norm. But I don't think that this strategy is very promising, because in order to answer the question whether to believe P, we systematically, not only normally, but systematically look at whether P. And more importantly, we never look at whether by believing P, we would thereby know it. If we ask the question whether we know something, what we are asking is not what belief to form, but whether there is something wrong in the grounds on the basis of which we believe already something. So our reflection on what to believe is systematically and exclusively guided by consideration about the truth of P and never about the knowledge of P. So it seems that the unique focus is on truth and truth-relevant considerations in deliberating about what to believe, and not just a necessary condition to achieve knowledge. Notice that knowledge considerations that don't count as reason to believe. Truth-relevant considerations count as reason to believe. So, but it's raining is a reason for me to believe it's not a good day. But that I don't have a reliable belief that it's raining is not a reason to believe that it's not a good day. Another aspect of the phenomenology indicates that truth is a better candidate. When we discover that some belief is true but not knowledge, we do not assess the belief as wrong or defective. We do not say that we should revise it. We do not criticize the belief in itself. On the contrary, we say that it was right to believe that thing. So we criticize other features of surrounding beliefs, such as the way in which the belief was initially formed, and other false beliefs in the vicinity, and so on. And interestingly, there are many analogies in the practical domain. So we have the very same type of reaction when we assess cases in which we follow a practical norm. For example, when we cross the street with green lights, but ignore that there were traffic lights, or when we luckily end up keeping a promise, even if we completely forgot about it, we say that we did the right thing, but we criticize the way in which we did it. We criticize it as unsafe, careless, lucky. So if we take this analogy seriously, if what we ought to do in such cases is to keep promise and stop at red lights, what we should believe is the truth, no more than that. So a prima facie conclusion is that analogy in the phenomenology of deliberation and assessment in the practical and epistemic domains clearly suggests that truth is the norm belief, not knowledge. So the second point in favor of the truth norm is that knowledge norm leads to an implausible permissivism, and the truth norm is better suited to avoid. So let me start introduce two forms of permissivism. Those are very sketched views. So moderate permissivism is that there are circumstances in which a subject is permitted to either believe or suspend judgment on a given proposition. So this kind of permissivism is usually discussed in debates such as in peer disagreement, and involves a quite moderate kind of permissivism in the sense that it allows a subject to suspend judgment or form a belief in specific circumstances. extreme permissivism is the view that a subject is always and in every circumstances epistemically permitted to suspend judgment on a given proposition. Is the idea there are no positive obligations to believe anything at all. Epistemic norms tell us only what we are permitted or forbidden to believe, not to believe anything. And the upholders of the knowledge norm are extreme permissivists. So they hold that it is not the job of epistemic norms to tell us what to believe, only what not to believe. The knowledge norm only forbids believing a proposition when this is not known, but doesn't say anything at all on what the subject should positively believe. So this view entails that for any proposition whatsoever, no matter how supported by old or new evidence, whether already believed or not, or any other fact in the circumstance, the subject is always epistemically permitted to suspend judgment. This seems to have some prima facie counterintuitive consequences. First, it seems that this norm is too weak, it's insufficiently demanding, because the view allows that the subject to suspend judgment despite overwhelming evidence, obvious available evidence for a proposition. Consider a case such as a politician who, despite overwhelming evidence, still refrains from believing in the existence of global warming, or take any other case of wishful thinking. Also, this norm makes epistemically permissible to abandon obvious self-evident beliefs, such as that I exist, or that 2 plus 2 is 4, or Inge's proposition, if there are. Another consequence is that the optimal way to follow a knowledge norm is to adopt a general skeptical disposition, to avoid opinions about as many things as possible. Of course, we can also follow the norm by believing only what we know, but to be sure to follow the norm, to exclude every possibility of violating the norm, the best option is to suspend judgment on everything, be complete skeptics on everything. And finally, extreme permissivism excludes the possibility of decisive reason to believe. This is something. So there is a standard reply in the literature, as due to Nelson, Whiting, Clayton, Williamson. Sometimes we have duties to believe certain things, but these duties are never grounded exclusively in purely epistemic standards. Rather, they are a result of a mesh of epistemic and practical considerations. They derive from epistemic norms combined with other sources of normativity, such as morality, prudence, instrumental rationality. So positive obligations to believe are the result of practical needs, goals, and duties aimed at settling one's opinion on a certain matter. So in order to satisfy practical norms to believe something, we need to form a belief. And it's only at that point that the epistemic norm enter in the game, determining which beliefs are permissible and which are not. But there are no epistemic obligations to believe, only practical obligations to form a belief. So this reply seems to address the contradictory consequences considered above, because in specific cases the subject is not allowed to suspend judgment, but this is due to practical reasons, according to this reply. So for example, in the case of the politician who refrains from believing global warming, the politician has moral duties to consider the available evidence and eventually form adequate belief on the matter. But he has no, this obligation is practical, it's not prudential. Similarly, it's epistemically permissible to abandon obvious beliefs, such as that I exist, but this is not recommendable from a prudential point of view. And similar responses are available for the other points I mean. So, okay, let's skip this. So the problem with this reply, I think, is that it can address a wide range of concerns. It can address all the cases in which forming belief is practically relevant, such as when it is driven by personal interest or obligations. But not all cases in which we recognize duties to believe can be explained by non-epistemic normative considerations. There are cases in which intuitively the subject should believe a certain proposition without having any practical reason whatsoever for doing this, and even in spite of practical reasons not to form a belief on a certain matter. So the cases I have in mind involve a specific kind of attention, specific kind of salience. This is a psychological focus involving awareness and attention on specific features of the circumstance, of the environment. This is a purely cognitive psychological phenomenon. It is not intentional, not necessarily brought about by any intentional action. It can be fully involuntary. For example, the aware contemplation of something one is looking at, or the fully aware focus on one's attention on a specific proposition, whose truth seems self-evident to the subject. And importantly, silence is different from other intentional attitudes, such as consciously considering whether a proposition is true. So considering is a voluntary act that, by directing the attention toward the question whether P, often puts you in the condition of attending the truth of P. Attentive focus is something that often happens to us, cannot be voluntarily controlled. Consideration can orient the direction of our focus, but is neither sufficient nor necessary for this type of salience. So let me illustrate the point with some example. Suppose you are at a cafe with your sister. She loves counting things around her. You know this, it's a passion of her. And you know that she's also very reliable on this. And at some point, your sister tells you, in total, there are other 5 people in this cafe. So you distinctly listen to this, you understand what she's saying, you don't care at all how many people are in the cafe, but it seems clearly unreasonable if you were paying attention to what she was saying not to believe and instead to suspend judgment on that proposition. And this seems to be irrational from an epistemic point of view, because there are no practical reasons in the background. Or suppose that you are in a, sorry for the clock is on the, so if you are waiting in a queue, you are a nervous person, you start doing things that without any specific purpose, such as looking at the clock without any curiosity for what time is it, but at some point in full awareness you look at the clock and you clearly see that it indicates 5. You see what the clock indicates. So it seems completely unreasonable in this case not to form the belief that it is 5 p.m. if you are attending to the clock in a focused way. So let's skip this. Okay, last case. So the number on the screen is 15. I repeat, the number on the screen is 15. Everybody is looking at the screen. So this number is 15. The number on the screen is 15. Okay. So I think that everybody in this room now is believing that the number on the screen is 15. But I also think that if someone of you in this moment, after paying attention to what I said, after looking at the screen, and after listening to me repeating this many times, doesn't believe that the number on the screen is 15, is an epistemically defective person. It has some genuinely epistemic problem. And the problem is that this person didn't form the belief on this proposition. And this defect seems to be genuinely epistemic. Nobody of you maybe had an interest to know that the number on the screen is 15. So, in the cases in which I present, those are just examples, it seems fully wrong and unreasonable not to form the belief when the information becomes salient in the relevant way. So in all such cases, we can easily stipulate that the subject has no interest, needs, desire, or duty to acquire the information. There is absolutely no reason for the subject to form a belief about the relevant proposition, such as a reason to consider the question whether the proposition is true. Maybe in the case of 15, yeah. But yeah, anyway, you can think of cases in which there is absolutely no reason at all. And we can even conceive cases in which it is in our interest not to acquire the information. And nonetheless, if rational, we should believe it, and it's irrational to refrain from believing it. It's an epistemic fault not to do it. This is the case. There are cases in the literature illustrating the difference between instrumental rationality and epistemic rationality. Just, for example, we don't want to know how a movie will end. We are watching the movie, but a friend tells us very clearly how it will end, and we understand what he is saying. In this case, we have all reason not to, practical reason not to believe what he is saying, but it seems epistemically unreasonable to refrain from believing this. We have an epistemic duty to believe in this case. So the best explanation of those cases, I don't know why there are such problems with the presentation, but sometimes in specific circumstances, for example, when certain propositions became salient, epistemic norms positively require us to believe something. So there is a possible solution for knowledge normers, suggested recently by Williamson in one of his talks, and this is to add to the knowledge norm other positive duties capable of accounting for such cases. So implement the system with some salience, truth knowledge or truth norm. So here it seems that a truth norm will fare much better than a knowledge norm in accommodating positive epistemic requirements. This is because a truth norm can admit both a negative and epistemic duty not to believe falsities without generating any contradiction between the two norms and without making the two norm trivial in any sense. For a knowledge norm, it's very difficult to fulfill this task. So in the case of the truth norm, you can see here an example of a positive duty to add to the negative duty. Positive duty to believe a proposition if the proposition is true and salient, or if the proposition is salient, to believe the proposition if it is true. If you add these to the norm not to believe the proposition if it is false, those two norms are both interesting in a sense, they can account for a lot of things, they are not trivial, and they are compatible because their antecedent condition is mutually exclusive. Cases in which a proposition is false don't overlap with cases in which a proposition is true. However, things are much more difficult for knowledge normers. Think to possible candidates to add to the knowledge norm. An evidential norm to believe a proposition if decisively supported by evidence, or a norm on suspending judgment suggested recently by Williamson, not exactly this formulation, but something similar. The idea is that we shouldn't suspend judgment on a proposition if there is decisive evidence for one proposition or the other. Or think also be in a position to know norms or a truth norm like the one I discussed before in terms of science and truth. So the main problem with adding these and other norms to the knowledge norm is that there will be inevitably circumstances in which these norms will issue specific requirements which are incompatible with the knowledge norm, generating implausible conflicts of epistemic obligation. So it is easy to think of cases in which a subject doesn't know that P or wouldn't know P by believing it, but meets the condition required by any one of those norms. The proposition is decisively supported by subject's evidence, the subject is in a position to know, proposition is true, proposition is true and salient, and so on. So what's bad with epistemic conflicts of obligation? Well, we experience normative conflicts in other domains in which conflicts of norm occur. However, we systematically fail to experience any conflict in the epistemic case, both at first personal deliberation about what to believe, and the third personal judgment. For example, when we realize that Mary believed that P on the basis of salient overwhelming evidence of P, but that evidence was misleading and she thereby doesn't know the proposition, our reaction is not to judge Mary as having been under a genuine conflict or a dilemma in which she has been forced to necessarily disobey one of her epistemic duties. Rather, whatever we think about this case, since that whatever Mary should believe, we do not consider her on a par with a person that made two incompatible promises and cannot keep both of them, or anyway, it's in a situation in which is in conflict of practical obligation. It seems inappropriate to diagnose the case of Mary as one involving a genuine epistemic conflict or a dilemma. And we can think to similar cases where we substitute overwhelming evidence with truth and science, with being in a position to know, with judgment in situation of suspension of judgment in situation of overwhelming evidence, and so on. So those norms lead to conflict with the knowledge norm, and this is bad. There is a norm that doesn't lead to any conflict, and this is the norm that we should believe P if we know that P. So this norm doesn't avoid any conflict with the knowledge norm, original knowledge norm, because, again, the condition of those norms are compatible. The case in which the subject doesn't know, shouldn't believe. The case in which the subject knows, subject should believe. But this norm has two different problems. One is that this norm is always trivially satisfied if we admit that knowledge implies belief. So there are no circumstances in which this norm is interesting for the site, because every time we know, we believe, and if we should believe P, if we know that P, this norm is impossible to violate. And as many philosophers pointed out, there are no norms that it is impossible to violate. And secondly, this norm fails to capture the intuition that there are things we are required to believe what we do not already believe, such as the example based on science indicated before. Okay, so in conclusion, the knowledge norm alone leads to an implausible form of permissivism. And one cannot add to the knowledge norm other norms in order to avoid this permissivism without very bad consequences. This norm will either generate a requirement incompatible with the knowledge norm, or they will be insufficiently demanding and trivially satisfied. Maybe there is some way for the knowledge norm to avoid these problems with ad hoc restrictions, super complex norms, or things like this. But the truth norm has a very simple and straightforward way of avoiding those problems. So why not prefer the knowledge norm, at least for explanatory reasons? So how much time do you have?
5 minutes.
Okay, perfect. So I prepared some response to arguments favoring the knowledge norm against the truth norm, but I would like to focus on a specific argument that has been discussed in various formulation by different philosophers, such as Beard, Clayton, and has been rehearsed recently by Williamson, both in print and in his some lectures. So it is that knowledge explains other norms or assessment of belief better than the truth norm. So we assess beliefs along various dimensions, both internal and external. We assess them according to whether they are true or false, reliable, supported by evidence, whether we know them. Now, mere true beliefs are not completely satisfactory. They are not fully defensible. A truth norm is insufficient alone to explain all the other dimension of assessment of beliefs. At least there is not an easy solution, as someone familiar with the literature will know. So we should read the nice book of John Gibbons on this topic. More than 100 pages of the book are directed to show that it's not easy at all to derive a secondary norm from a truth norm. On the contrary, if a belief amounts to knowledge, it is defensible along all its various dimensions of assessment, because it is true, it is reliable, supported by reason. So it seems knowledge is the condition for maximal positive epistemic assessment belief, is the condition for full defensibility or defensibility along all the dimensions of assessment of belief. So knowledge norm is the most inclusive norm, in the sense that it can imply all the other norms, but not vice versa. So this norm promises to unify and explain all the various standards of belief assessment. This seems to be a good argument for a knowledge norm. This is the idea. But believe only what you know implies that you should believe the truth, but not vice versa. So I think that there is a problem with this response, and the problem is with this assumption. So define maximal positive assessment of X as the claim that X is fully defensible or all dimension of positive assessment of X are satisfied. So if C is the condition for maximal positive assessment of X, then norms governing X require C. So this claim, I think, is false. We should never expect, in any circumstance whatsoever, that all dimensions of assessment of an X can be explained by what norm governing X require. On the contrary, the condition sufficient to grant the maximal positive assessment of an X is never the condition required by such a norm. And I am going to argue for this in the last part of my talk. So let's start distinguishing between conformity and compliance to a norm. So if a norm requires condition C, the subject conforms to the norm if the subject satisfies the condition. So if the norm is don't pass if lights are red, the subject passes when the lights are red, and this is enough to conform to the norm. A subject complies with the norm if, in addition to conforming to the norm, the subject conforms because follows the norm, or on the basis of sufficient reason provided by the norm. So subject passes because she accepts and tries to follow the law, she sees the green light, she responds appropriately to normative considerations, and so on. So one of the two premises of my argument is that other things being equal, merely conforming to a norm is always worse than complying with it. Complying to a norm is more defensible, is less criticizable than complying with a norm by mere accident or by luck or on unsafe grounds. So we can think of every case in the practical domain of norms in which a subject comply rather than conforming. And it's clear that we take as more defensible, as less criticizable the subject that complies. The conscientious driver that pay attention to the traffic light when it passes at the crossroad is available as better, more defensible than the reckless driver that doesn't care at all about street regulations. Or the agent that keep a promise for right reasons is better than someone that do it by mere accident. Now, the second premise is that for every norm, the conditions for conformity and compliance are different. It is always possible to conform to what the norm requires, but fail to comply with it. So the argument here is that the compliance to norm involves doing what the norm requires because of the reason that the norm provides. And this requires acting on the basis of the norm. But in order to do this, the subject must know what specific action the norm recommends. However, we can fail to know which specific action the norm recommends, but still conform to the norm, as it has been convincingly argued, for example, by Hawthorne and Srinivasan. They provide an argument that for any plausible, for any norm in general, we could not be in a position to know whether its conformity condition obtained. We can pass at the red light and the light is green, but fail to know it. And in the same way, we can believe B and P is true, but not know that B, and so on. So if compliance to norm requires that the subject knows the specific action that the norm recommends, but we can fail to know which specific action the norm recommends and at the same time conform to the norm, it follows that we can conform to the norm but fail to comply with it. So from those two premises, other things being equal, merely conforming to a norm is always worse than complying with it. And for every norm, it is possible to conform to what the norm requires but fail to comply with it. It follows straightforwardly that for every norm, conformity is never sufficient to achieve maximal positive assessment. At least also compliance is needed. Now add the main premise of the argument for in defense of the knowledge norm, that the condition for maximal positive epistemic assessment of belief is knowledge. And you reach the conclusion that knowledge cannot be the norm of belief. It cannot be the conformity condition of the norm. Most knowledge is the compliance condition of the norm. The norm must require a weaker condition. You can see the argument graphically here. If compliance is always better than conformity, and knowledge is full defensibility, so either is compliance or more than that, then conformity is some condition that is weaker than knowledge, necessary. So just let me conclude. There are at least two reasons to prefer a true norm to a knowledge norm, I argued. Phenomenological considerations based on analogy between the practical and the epistemic domain, the unique focus on truth and indexed deliberation, and the way in which we assess our beliefs, and the implausible extreme permissivism that the knowledge norm leads us, plus the fact that very difficult for the knowledge norm to implement the normative framework with other norms without generating conflict or triviality, while for the truth norm, everything is quite easy in doing that. I also defended the truth norm against an argument supposed to favor a knowledge norm over a truth norm. I show that this argument is unsuccessful. If anything, it speaks against the knowledge norm. All this is, I think, good evidence that truth, not knowledge, is the norm of belief. Sorry for the graphic. And thank you for your attention.